Across the city and South Cambridgeshire.
On FM, digital and your mobile.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Hi, mate.
How are you doing?
I'm all right. It's been a while, hasn't
it? Yeah, yeah.
I think it was Christmas I was last here.
Was it Christmas?
Yeah, yeah.
We're feeling festive.
There's lots of good food here.
You've got jams and pickles and preserves and meats and beer and all kinds of things.
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm going to have a feast now.
God, Allah, Buddha, bless Mill Road. Mill Road is awesome.
You could taste chocolate forever, like really good chocolate.
Yeah, it's pretty wonderful.
Gingerbread men of all shapes and sizes.
Whoa, that's fizzy. Yeah, that takes your head off.
And the food is great, and the wine is obviously fantastic.
Doesn't that look lovely?
We had music all day. I did pancakes all day.
Holly, Tiny Robins.
At the end of the night, we all eat together with the staff.
I love this place. It's unique in Cambridge.
You've got people and you've got food, and that's all you need, and conversation springs forth.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Christmas edition of Flavour. I'm Matt Bentman.
And I'm Sue Bailey.
Sadly, Alan Alder is unable to join us, but we do have plenty of Christmas treats for you today on Flavour.
We get some cooking ideas from our resident cook, Rosie Sykes. We find out what some people from the Cambridge area will be eating.
And if you have any last-minute crises and are unable to prepare your own Christmas dinner, there is a local pub that may just be able to help out.
Away from Christmas, we have Felicity Cloak from the Guardian's Feast section, and she'll be talking about her column and her forthcoming book.
Also today, there is a new waffle shop to tell you all about, and a pub with an impressive menu too. So, to begin, one of the things I know that Alan looks forward to every week is Feast. This is the food section of the Saturday Guardian. It features people like Yota Motolenghi, Anna Jones, Rachel Roddy, who we had on the programme last year, and the food writer that she really admires, Felicity Cloak.
Felicity's column usually takes a dish and looks into how different food writers make it, reports on what the different versions are like, and then she takes the best idea from each to produce the perfect version. I met Felicity, who was born at the Rosie Maternity Hospital, and asked her how she got started in food writing.
I actually started off in publishing, nothing to do with food really, art publishing actually. I left because I really wanted to write myself. Food was one of the things that I was interested in. I don't have any formal cookery training. What I love about food is that you can write about so many different topics. There's travel, there's history, there's science.
What got you started writing for The Guardian?
It came about by chance because I ended up, and I was working for magazines at the time, food magazines, and I went on a trip. This was in the glory days before the financial crash when tourist boards would send journalists away on trips to write articles. And I went to Las Vegas to write about the culinary revolution there. So it was an interesting time, lots of big chefs from around the world setting up there. I was on the trip with a woman from The Guardian who was so cynical about all of this. It's brilliant. She was really good fun. And we ended up having a really great time, lots of interesting chats. And when we came back, we stayed in touch, and she asked me if I'd write something sort of on the side, moonlight for her. And I was so delighted by the idea of writing for my favourite paper that I thought she said that she would pay me £5 for an article. I was happy to do it for £5. Later, I find out it was £85, which still isn't a king's ransom, but was slightly better. I probably would have paid her for £5 to be in The Guardian at the time. Mm-hmm. So it's worked out nicely for me, my favourite paper.
And was it your idea to do the perfect analysis of dishes?
No, I'd like to say it was, because it's a really great idea. But in fact, it came about by accident. So the series started off looking at food myths. Things like, if it's true, you shouldn't wash mushrooms. You know, whether there's truth in the notion of sealing meat before you cook it. All of that stuff. Then it evolved. We did one about the best way to cook a sausage. You know, all the accompanying jokes about pricks with forks, etc. And it was online, and the comments underneath went wild because British people love to talk about sausages, turned out. So we thought, well, we're onto something here. So the next week we did how to cook mash. And again, I mean, we love mash. And that's when it became the series that it became. So it probably had about 3 months of being something a little bit different, but then this worked. I mean, we hit upon something, and then it's been going ever since, which is 8 years ago.
I've always read your columns because you do this
I wouldn't say boringly forensic, but in a detailed analysis of what works, what doesn't work, and then what you think is the definitive, hence the, you know, the perfect title. And I just love that whole approach, which I think is fantastic.
It's always fascinating. I quite often go in, you know, being interested in a dish but not thinking I know that dish. And a little bit like salad nichoise, I thought I knew what salad nichoise was, and to be honest, I thought I wasn't that keen on it because I don't really like tinned tuna as one of the few foodstuffs I just don't like. But when I started digging into it and sort of finding sources, like there's this chap called Jacques Médecin, who was the mayor of Nice in, I think, the 60s and 70s. He was a little bit of an unpleasant character, sort of politically. I think he was quite far right, but also he was sent down for vast amounts of embezzlement. He did, however, write a really good cookbook, which has been republished quite recently by Grub Street in English. Mm. He gives a lot of strictures about salad nichoise, and actually it's traditionally made with anchovies rather than tuna. And when I was there this summer, I found that I was served both with it, which was a surprise. But there's, you know, lots of things like cooked potatoes have no place in there, apparently, quite often find in British versions. But, you know, everyone's squabbling. Mm-hmm. You approach something that you think is going to be quite straightforward and find something quite different. Yeah, it's always interesting.
And so from this, a number of books have ensued, have they not?
So I've done 5 books.
Tell me a little bit more about your latest book.
So my latest book is Completely Perfect. A really immodest title. It's more referring to the fact that although I do think that all of the recipes in there are perfect, it's sort of a greatest hits of the columns. I've been through the last 8 years of recipes and I've picked out the ones that I think are the things that I would use sort of day to day, but also the stuff like Christmas cake. It's everything from a steak and ale pie to a fish curry. There's the things that most people would want in their repertoire. I think you could eat very well from that book for the rest of your life. It's not Delia's, I wouldn't dare to say it was Delia's complete cookery course, but it's something approaching that with a more modern bent. You know, there's nothing in aspic there, but there is a quiche noire.
So who would you suggest buying your book for?
What I think is, people say is useful about a column is that obviously it's all of my, you know, perfection is a very, very subjective thing. But I tell you what other people do, and so you can say, oh, well, actually, I really like tinned tuna, and I'm going to use that. And so you've got the options there to say, stuff you, Felicity, I think you're wrong, I'm going to go with Jacques or whoever. Mm. So, yeah, I just think it gives a lot of options.
Mm. And it's interesting that it's gone back to a sort of paperback format without photographs, which is a sort of heritage of cookbooks from the 50s, 60s and so on.
It's been the 20th anniversary recently of the publication of Nigella's How to Eat, and they've reissued that in the same format, but originally that didn't have it, had sort of illustrations but no pictures. And she said to me that she doesn't think that would be published these days because of the lack of pictures, but for publishers it's often a financial thing. Food photographs are incredibly expensive to produce. But also what I like about it is that it makes it more timeless. I think that photographs date very, very quickly with food.
How much research do you have to do?
It really varies on the recipe. So I have an enormous collection of cookbooks at home. I live in a tiny flat in North London and one entire wall is floor to ceiling cookbooks. There's now piles everywhere as well because it's outgrown that and I don't really know what to do, so I buried my head in the sand about that. I may well find myself or the dog crushed by cookbooks at some point next year. So if it's something Italian, then quite often it's a case of taking all of those off to the shelf, looking for the recipe, if they've got it, then comparing all the different ones and picking out the ones that have a point of difference. So quite a lot of them might actually be quite similar. And sometimes you can see threads running through where people have taken other recipes as inspiration, which is interesting. But with less familiar cuisines, then there's a lot of online stuff. Actually, particularly for American dishes, the internet is a great place for that. Just finding recipes. It's usually a morning, but it could be a whole day. And then sometimes I ask online if there's something that I think that other people have more expertise. And I did that recently for Irish stew. Oh my word, I was fielding the responses for about a day and there was a big debate about cultural appropriation. A friend sent me his mum's recipe, lots of people scanned really old Irish cookbooks for me. You know, I even found out where to buy the right potatoes. Went off on a little jaunt on my bike and went up to the Holloway Road where there's an Irish butcher and got the proper potatoes.
And also you're doing some work on another cookbook, I gather, at the moment.
I am. Well, it's not a cookbook, actually. It does have recipes in it, but it's a first for me. It's a travelogue. So last summer I spent couple of months cycling around France, and it was my own Tour de France, but instead of taking in mountains and things like that, it's around the 21 classic dishes of France, as decreed by me, just to match the 21 official stages of the tour. So it's an account of that and all the highs and lows along the way, but also all the stuff that I picked up. So I ended up going to some really interesting regional museums and talking to sort of cheesemakers and things like that. Oh, it was brilliant. It was such good fun. I'm sort of currently in my head, even though I'm in North London in December, in my head I'm in Lyon in June, and that's a really nice place to be.
Do you think standard French food, are they still cooked as classics there?
I sort of vary between saying it is not the food that was held up on a pedestal by people like Elizabeth David in the 60s. Certainly, right. Shortcuts are now taken. It's not a guarantee that you can stumble across an amazing meal in every little French village. But on the other hand, the standard is still so much higher than it is in the UK. In general, I'd say, and you can eat brilliantly in the UK, but you just need to do a bit more research, whereas in France it's easier to just get a decent meal. But that doesn't mean a superlative meal. Perhaps it's unfair to expect it. But what I will say is payoff for that is the variety is so much smaller, and you will get the same dishes again and again, and it'll be made with care. What I found interesting was I'm used to quite varied and strong flavours. And, you know, I love spicy things. I love anchovies. I love Marmite. I love lots of garlic. And when I got to Marseille, having gone down the west coast, and I had a classic Marseille pizza, because I've been told by Jonathan Meads, who I met out there, who lives out there, that the classic dish of Marseille is actually pizza, because there's lots of immigrants from southern Italy in the 19th century, and Marseille, he reckons, does pizza best than Naples. And I got this pizza, you know, no cheese on it at all, and the smell of garlic was extraordinary. And I thought, even though I've been in France, I haven't eaten that much really pungent garlic, because actually, a lot of classic French cuisine that's not from that very southern portion is quite restrained. It's quite almost seems sort of bland to my palate. But once you start appreciating for what it is, it's complex, but it just doesn't have those sort of grandstanding flavours that we're used to now. Maybe it's actually more akin to how food would have been probably in this country. You know, quiet flavours, quietly pleasurable.
What is your book going to be called?
It's called One More Croissant for the Road, mostly because I am a late convert to the croissant. I really didn't like them until I think it was 2011, and I bought one for a friend, and I picked up one for myself because I thought it was a bit mean to let her eat. I'd gone to get her up because we were going to do something together, so I still burst in. I knew she'd been out the night before, and I thought, I'll bring you coffee and a croissant. And I thought, well, I'll bring myself a croissant. No one likes to eat alone. And I ate it, and I thought, oh, I'm missing out here. Ooh. I don't know why I didn't like them. So I've been making up for lost time, and I started doing this thing where occasionally I will, once a week, I will find a different croissant and I will eat it as an excuse for eating it. I'll rate it online. So in France, almost every morning, and not every morning for various reasons, like in Marseille, the district I was staying in had a big Arab population, so I ate something entirely different. But I had a croissant and I rated it. I've come back with a lot of scores and a lot of pictures of croissant. My phone memory is 70% croissant pictures.
And that was Felicity Cloak, whose new book, Completely Perfect, is out now, and at a very reasonable price. And the book about France is due next June, something to look forward to. I must say, I know Alan shares her passion for croissants. He didn't rate them individually, but certainly the best he's ever had aren't from France at all, but from the Baltic Bakehouse in Liverpool. They experimented long and hard to produce the best, and they finally hit on the idea of making them from strudel dough. They are fantastic, crisp on the outside and soft and full of flavour on the inside.
Does he have a favourite one in Cambridge?
Oh yeah, yeah. He must have tried every croissant in most cafes in Cambridge, and the best, or the best at the moment, because these things change of course, are the ones from Newnham Bakery Cafe in Derby Street. They're quite similar to the ones from the Baltic Bakehouse. The worst, if you're interested in this sort of thing, are from the cafes in IKEA. Ghastly, he thinks. Actually, he once had a pre-packed one from a French supermarket, which was almost as bad. So supermarkets are to be avoided in France too. Do you have a favourite croissant, Sue?
Well, I do. I must admit, I do like croissants. A decent butter croissant. There's nothing better than that, which you actually then don't have to add any butter and jam to. You can just sort of taste the flavour of it all by itself. But I try not to indulge too much because I think I'd probably get too much of a passion for them if I was to go around trying them all like Alan does.
Well, they are so lush, aren't they? I actually like the procedure of, you know, basting the butter in and getting the Nutella or the chocolate spread.
Yes, I must admit, just as one of our Christmas morning treats, we do have croissants, we do have smoked salmon, and we have scrambled eggs. So it's either toss up between croissants and bagels, and we have both. And it's interesting to see who goes for which one. Now on to the first of two slots for Rosie Sykes. In this one, she talks about making cranberry sauce and stuffing for the Christmas meal.
When I make my cranberry sauce, which I think is really, really nice with a goose or a duck or a turkey, because it adds a nice bit of acidity and another sort of dimension, especially with all the other kind of fatty things, I tend to make it a bit like applesauce and then put cranberries in towards the end. Basically stew some lovely cooking apples with some sage, a tiny bit of sugar, but I tend to use apple juice, some butter, so you get this lovely smoothness, then throw in the cranberries at the end and you'll have a really nice light sauce that just goes really well with the meat of choice and with the ham, actually, if you have ham.
The apple is a cooking apple or an
yes,
eating apple?
Yes, a cooking apple, right. A Bramley. For sure. The other thing I tend to do for Christmas is a really nice stuffing made with chestnuts and some dried fruit. I do it a bit sort of Middle Eastern with breadcrumbs, but with figs, red onions, a load of lemon zest and some chopped up chestnuts. I think all those nice sort of soft Christmassy spices work really well, and a bit of garlic add a different dimension.
And Rosie will be along again a little later with advice on making gravy. Now, on my way down Mill Road recently, I spotted a new business opening up. I was immediately struck with a rather kind of Quentin Blake vibe. You know, the artist who illustrates Roald Dahl's books? The way he used to draw sweet shops with those bright colours, those bell glass jars on the walls. Well, this shop specialises in one particular type of food that is waffly versatile.
Come on, I'll make you some waffles.
Okay, so to make a waffle, the butter is poured into the waffle iron. We close the top and we wait till it gets golden and crispy on the edges. Pour the warm chocolate on there, and then we go on to the fruits and the toppings, and if they want, to the ice cream.
We must have waffles.
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 Waffles. A new shop has opened up on Mill Road, just over the bridge on the Romsey side, and it's run by a man called Bulent.
My name is Bulent Selik. This is Cambridge Waffle Bar, 184 Mill Road.
Bulent Selik and his friend Hakan have just started this business. They're Turkish. Bulent has been in Cambridge since 94. Barbering has been his main trade all this time, and he's been running a barber's in King Street since 2003, but...
This is something I really wanted to do since 2008.
Because that's when he first tasted waffles.
I never had waffle before 2008 when we went to Istanbul, you know, a friend of mine. We had some food and afterwards he said, do you fancy a waffle? And I said, waffle, you know, what is waffle? He said, you never had a waffle? I said, no. And he took me to this place. It was only a small place. It was a very famous place in Istanbul. When I ate one, I just wanted another one. We were there 4 days, and honestly, every night after thing, I was like, let's go have a waffle.
I'm told it was a beautiful Belgian day. The smell of waffles and Brussels sprouts filled the summer air.
Yeah, we basically use wheat flour, oil, sugar, and sort of semi-skimmed milk.
Man, you guys ain't had no waffles like these. These waffles are so good. They like they come from down south.
When I turned up here yesterday, this place was packed.
Yeah, honestly, like, it's new business and we've been rushed by the neighbours, really. They said that we should open for the Mill Road Fair.
Yeah.
We came to Mill Road for the winter fair. We normally come each year.
We walked past and there was a big queue outside.
Which we did, and we had a fantastic day.
Hey, when I think of waffles, I always think of chocolate, maybe strawberries on top. Mm-hmm. A customer can order any number of toppings that they want.
Yes, they do, they do. I'll be honest with you, though, it's... Most people do like Nutella. I don't know, I think the reason for that is in the other places that does this business, they only use Nutella as a chocolate, you know, the real chocolate. Because Nutella has more butter in there, that's why it's spreadable. It's more butter rather than the pureness of the chocolate. So, you know, there is a plenty of choice. I personally like banana, strawberry and blueberries. That's what my, you know, I like this three mix. Yeah. And I always have some nuts on there.
Some waffles, man! Extra syrup!
But the other thing that I didn't know when we started is maple syrup. It's incredible, you know, like how much people actually like maple syrup. One of the interesting things we're doing is tahini and grape syrup. Something that, again, is very traditional in Turkey. Mm. So we're going to do that and see what people think. I do the grape syrup and tahini and pistachio on it. Everybody tried. They're like, oh, it's amazing. So,
what toppings did you choose today?
Whipped cream and maple syrup.
I had blueberries and maple syrup. Lois, do you want to say what you had? Oh, well, our six-year-old had chocolate sauce. Chocolate sticks and marshmallows and chocolate sauce. Did
blueberries
I say
as
that?
Well? Blueberries as well, maybe?
Oh, yeah, and blueberries.
Blueberries as well, yeah. So four toppings. They were sharing between two of them, though, so that was okay, yeah.
Now, of course, the thing about waffles is that you can have sweet and savoury versions.
Be honest with you, I never tried savoury waffles. Mm. But so many people have been saying, are you going to do savoury and if you're going to do breakfast? Sort of talking to people and doing a little bit of research, we decided we are going to do savoury breakfast and also we're doing gluten-free as well. Mm. So the breakfast thing, we're going to do poached eggs, halloumi, olives and spinach. You know, salmon, cream cheese, avocado, things like this, you know. And in the lunchtime, we will be doing, there's a couple of options. We're going to do beef, pesto and mozzarella and a couple of different choices. We tried these things with customers and good response, so we're going to put them on the menu.
This is the waffle bar on Cambridge Mill Road.
I think it's a thing also, you have to sort of experiment, you know, you've got to try because we never done this business before. And like while we're sort of creating this breakfast and savory, we tried things like putting spinach in the dough before we cook and stuff. So, you know, we're going to start with these things, what we're doing, and then trying to be creative as the time goes by.
Absolutely delicious. High praise because one of our daughters, she's not that keen, but she said, I've managed to eat it all. And so she loved it.
Something we've witnessed over the last 5 or 6 years is the development of this side of Mill Road. We've seen the beginnings of a relevant record cafe, urban larder and so on. Just gradually over the years, more and more cafes, and now there's you, and at the same time, the patisserie just up the road as well.
Yes, Turkish guys, they just, that's really great.
Hi, I'm Jansu from Bravo Patisserie. We have just opened late last month, and you can hear us in the future episode of Flavour.
It's like almost family orientated, you know, people who live around this side of the Mill Road, they really, you know, support the local Mill Road businesses, like you say, the Urban Lad, the fish and chips shop across the road.
I think when we walk down for the winter fair, we're struck by what a range of things there are. Qantas has come and have a sort of food trawl along Mill Road, really, because there's so many different things to try.
I feel like we've only been open sort of about 10 days now, 8-9 days. I feel like I belong here. And I have a really great feeling. This is going to be a good thing for us, I think. You know, within a few months, I think we'll be really busy and we'll be really happy here. It's something the mum and dad and grandma, granddad, everybody can have this, you know. I'm actually surprised that there is not many people think or did this before. So I think it would be a good business.
Well, you want some good food when you're not out hens. Big yellow sign is your new best friend. They got waffles and bacon and coffee too, but an all-star breakfast comes with some room.
He has a point. There are over 2,000 branches of the Waffle House chain alone in America, which have been going strong for 63 years. There are Waffle Houses in Norwich and St. Albans, a family business for the last 40 years. And of course, in Cambridge, we have Bernard Willeman's Waffles in the Market Square. Now we have Bulent serving up sweet and savoury waffles in this nice little shop.
We were just saying earlier that Cambridge could do with just a little place that does this kind of thing, that you can go out as a family or just as a couple or an individual and just go and get something that's, just easy and relatively reasonable. We thought the prices are great and service very good, so we thought, perfect really.
We're really happy.
Lovely, thank you very much, Bulent.
No problem.
So we are here at the Cambridge Waffle Bar on 184 Mill Road. Come along and check it out. And you're listening to Flavour, food and drink program on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Waffle House, do the right thing.
Many thanks to Bulent Selik. The Cambridge Waffle Bar will be open in the evenings. It is such a cosy little place, quite beautifully decorated too, with a multicoloured Turkish ceramics and coffee cups adorning the walls. A nice presentation of the product in the front window. Also, they've got Cambridge 105 radio playing on the speakers. They're tuned in to us from the day they opened. And I should also point out they do coffee and tea, ice cream from Purbex in Dorset, and fresh lemonade made on site daily. Their late opening hours, of course, reflecting that it's a nice place to go to after dinner if you fancy yourself a nice dessert or indeed something savoury. And that music signals time for the latest food tweets from the city. Sue?
Today at the Guildhall is the Enchanted Cinema. And also Jo Kraczynska's cakes are on sale there. Her stall is open until 8 p.m. tonight and everyone is welcome, not just cinema goers. There will be the classic afternoon teas, jars of chilli jam and chutney, last-minute prezzies and cheese scones. And at Calverley's Brewery in Hooper Street, Reggae Kitchen is serving until 3 and then again from 6 until 9 p.m.
Well, we've heard about making food, eating food. How about some historical food now? Trawling through the flavour archives, here is food journalist Andrew Webb.
This time on the historical bookshelf, we're thinking about Christmas. And the book I've chosen is A Calendar of Feasts, Capcurn Cakes and Lace by Julia Jones and Barbara Deer. It's an interesting book because my previous selections have all been quite old books from the 60s or the 50s or something like that. This book's actually from 1987, which makes it fairly modern for the historical bookshelf. On the back here it says, an enchanting 12-month calendar of traditional festivals and feast days and the foods, folklore and handicrafts associated with them. I mean, this is kind of interesting because it says here there's a bit about the authors. And Julia Jones has been making lace and crafts for many years, as well as giving courses on English cookery. There's a sort of folky movement that you don't imagine appearing in the 80s at all. We sort of imagine it in the 60s, and we looked at that in previous historical bookshelves in the 50s. And we sort of see it coming back now with the sort of rise in artisanal everything from brewing to cheeses to that sort of stuff. But you imagine in the 80s it was completely destroyed. But it seems no, there were people who were interested in these sort of high days and holidays and the food that went with them. There's a pull quote on the back here. This calendar of British feasts and festivals is a beautiful, readable and practical tribute to the richness of our culinary tradition. Buy one for bedtime and one for the kitchen. And that's by none other than the great lady herself, Delia Smith. The book's interesting because it takes food and recipes and weaves them around the year tied to various festivals and saints' days and folk traditions. And we've sort of forgotten that this is how the year was measured in olden times, from everything from the assizes to the terms of the colleges. So if we say Michaelmas term or Michaelmas night or Midsummer's Day or Martinmas, there was a time when these festivals and days punctuated the year. Design-wise, it's very 80s, but not in a kind of neon-y, modern-y, futuristic way. It's part of that sort of Laura Ashley revival that ran concurrent with, you know, new romantics, and it's very, very delicate, lots of flowers and pastel hues. And my copy actually is an old library book from Cumbria County Library, and it's quite beautiful, really, because it's still got a ticket in the front here, the old-fashioned ticket, and then it's been superseded by this barcode, and it's a discontinued book. So we've got here December, so we've got here Advent Sunday and various sorts of things. And in November, just before that, we had things like Stir Up Sunday, which is when you would make your Christmas pudding. But the day that I've picked out, and I think that's worthy of a quick look here, is December the 21st, which you may or may not know is St. Thomas's Day. So this is St. Thomas's Day or Thomas Mass, and it falls on the 21st, or very near the true solstice. So as well as recipes, which feature in the book quite a lot, you know, we've got here the Yule log, crystallised peel, roast turkey, and all that sort of stuff. There's actually quite a lot of old history in here, not only to do with the religious markings of the year, but older ones that go beyond that. And that it's these sort of little facts that I think really give the book depth. On St. Thomas's Eve, no work was done. Young unmarried girls, many areas, used to place a sprig of evergreen under their pillows and went to bed at night. There seems to be a lot of these festivals seem to be about meeting partners and men or women and unmarried maidens and wedding rings in cakes and all this sort of stuff. It's a charmingly written book in that regard because there is a lot of research and history here, and it gives gravitas to the recipes and the rest of the book. So there's a recipe here for a Yule log, and we're all familiar with Yule log, and we just buy them in the shops now, and the recipe involves Swiss roll tins and all that sort of stuff. But she's actually taken the time to give a bit of context to the Yule log, which, you know, a modern recipe book might not necessarily do. The tradition of burning a Yule log on Christmas Eve is an ancient one. A large forest log, found or given, but not bought, will be brought in with great ceremony into the manor house on this evening. Songs were sung in its honour and guests had to pay tribute before passing on. It was thought that as the log burned, it would burn away all the bad luck and old wrong. A small piece of one year's log would be kept to light the next year's log. As the tradition of burning the Yule log has died, we can keep the custom alive by baking a chocolate log. simpler times. So it's things like that that I think are really, really useful, because a lot of modern recipe books, even when they've got Christmas recipes in, there is no context. And this time of year particularly is one where we can connect with really old folk traditions, religious festivals, and these punctuate the year. I think we've lost a little bit of that. The rest of the book, just a charming little aside as well. So we've got here St. Catherine's Eve, Stirrup Sunday, of course. We've got that Mash of Nine Sorts. I like this one, in October. In some rural areas, it was usual at Halloween supper to serve Mash of Nine Sorts to unmarried guests, in which the lady of the house would have hidden her wedding ring. We've got St. Audrey's Day, October the 17th. Punky Night, which is the last Thursday in October. Slow gins in there, hot-baked wardens. Suffolk Fawzes, St. Bartholomew's Day in the middle of August. That was a great day for festivals. The Bartholomew Fairs, they were noted in Smithfield, London, was an absolute, kind of the Glastonbury of its day. It's fabulous that Julia and Barbara have structured a book around these. I see a lot of seasonal books, but they are done by month, and that's about it, really. It's a really interesting way to structure a book of recipes, and I think it's definitely one for your bookshelves too. That's A Calendar of Feasts, Catkern Cakes and Lace by Julia Jones and Barbara Deer, published by Doran Kinsley. Merry Christmas.
Many thanks to Andrew Webb. I never knew about Yule logs before. It's interesting how much we do comes from old rituals. There you go.
The Red Lion in Grantchester is doing a Christmas menu and also catering for the Grantchester Barrel Race on Boxing Day and for New Year's Eve too. I asked Lucy Hoolin what was popular from the Christmas menu.
Well, obviously, the turkey and obviously venison, the haunch of venison as well. And surprisingly, the cod. The cod is roasted, it's got roasted new potatoes, it's got charred grilled cabbage and it's served with hollandaise and it's absolutely delicious. And a lot of customers like it because it's not too heavy. We are doing some amazing soup, and a lot of customers like the soup, which is a sweet potato and coconut soup. Another thing which is absolutely going down very well is a slow gin cured salmon, and the crab scotch egg is one of our best sellers. That's off our normal menu, as long, and also the pie, the oxtail and beef shin pie. Ooh. We can't make enough of it. Christmas Day, we're booked up. We do an amazing £80 Christmas Day menu.
So no last-minute bookings there, then?
Well, we can probably squeeze a few people in if they call up and everything like that. I'm sure we've got a few tables that we can jig around and sort out. And then New Year's Eve. Well, actually, we've got the barrel run.
Grantchester barrel run.
Absolutely. Yes. On the 26th, that's Boxing Day. Everyone come along. We've got outside stalls. I think we're doing a barbecue. We've got coffees and teas and hot chocolates, as well as the a la carte menu happening inside. Very popular, very, very popular. We've never won it. So this is my first year here, so I actually haven't actually witnessed it. So I'm really looking forward to that. So I want to be outside. I don't want to be inside. I'm going to be outside cheering everyone on.
Oh, yes, the barrel rolling is absolutely quite a spectacle. Yes.
So I've been told. So, yeah, everyone come along. We've got spaces. You know, it's going to be a really family occasion. Lots of fun, lots of lovely food, different types of food, from outside food to inside to our menu as well. Ooh. So we're going to be very busy. And then on New Year's Eve, the normal a la carte menu, plus some really lovely specials that Yannick, our head chef, is organising. Don't know what they are. He's kept them under wraps. Oh. He hasn't told us yet, but we'll know nearer the time. And that starts, we serve food all day, but I think Swagger comes on at about 8 o'clock and we dance the night away till 1 o'clock in the morning.
Fantastic. And Swagger is...
a local band, 80s, 90s music.
So, that's what's going on at the Red Lion in Grantchester. Then I popped over the road to talk with Josh Vargo, the owner of the Green Man.
What types of dishes are you going to be having on your Christmas menu this year?
The local venison loin is my favourite dish, with the beetroot mash and the hazelnuts and the roast leeks. And
more so than the turkey?
I know, as an American, because of Thanksgiving...
You've already done the turkey.
I mean, I've eaten turkey my entire life so much, but I love turkey. Don't get me wrong, but...
Yeah. What do you find people tend to prefer?
You know, it's interesting turkey? Is we do a celeriac and chestnut apple suet pudding, and our cod and sweet corn fritter are really popular with the sweet potato. Especially in the last 12 to 18 months, we've really been more progressive in terms of vegetarian and vegan dishes. And yes, we do a lot of turkey, but all four of our dishes actually sell quite well. Well, puddings, the fun thing is with our Christmas pudding, it takes a year to make. I can tell you, when it says brandy sauce, there's a lot of brandy in that sauce. But I've always been a sucker for a sticky toffee pudding. Mm-hmm. But I like the fact that with our crumble, it's foraged. Mm-hmm. And so I've gone out with my chef and with his girlfriend, and we've picked the blackberries and picked everything. And the plums come from our garden. And so the foraged fruits always, I think we have a nice balance between the tart and the sweetness with that as well.
Josh Vargo from the Green Man in Grantchester there.
And also there's two other pubs in Grantchester, Matt.
Oh yeah?
There is the Rupert Brook and there's also the Blue Ball.
Of course.
And they are going to be fielding teams, as are the Red Lion and the Green Man, for the Boxing Day barrel race. So may the best pub win. But for those of us who are making our own dinner on Christmas Day, here's Rosie Sykes again, this time with advice on gravy.
One thing that people aren't always confident about at Christmas is gravy. My recommendation would be don't use a powder or a granule. If you haven't got time to make your own stock, you can buy really lovely fresh stocks now. And I would recommend you acquire some stock and reduce it. I never put any flour or anything in. I think gravy should just be a very nice, light sauce, not a very thick thing that sets as soon as it gets a little bit cold. So I would recommend that you simmer some stock with a lot of herbs like thyme, bay, maybe a bit of rosemary, perhaps a bit of garlic. Then when you've cooked your meat of choice, take it out of the pan and just add some either wine or apple juice, any kind of liquid. It doesn't have to be alcohol, but I would personally probably use white wine or cider. And put that tray back into the oven. Put a really decent amount of liquid so you've got a covering over the whole of the oven tray base. Then let it get hot for a minute and then get a balloon whisk and whisk the tray and you'll get all the delicious flavours from cooking the meat from the tray. Pour that through a sieve into your gravy, simmer it for a bit longer and you will have a really good depth of flavour for sure.
Now, Alan wrote this bit. He said, I had terrible experiences at school with gravy. Even now, the word makes me shudder. It was a concoction of boiled onion and flour, I think, with some brown colouring added. It was foul-smelling and it had a bitterness to it that destroyed whatever meat lay underneath it. But well-made gravy is such a pleasure. Actually, Tim Haywood of Fitzbillies wrote a long piece about it 3 years ago in the Financial Times, and in his piece from a couple of weeks ago about Christmas dinners from his childhood, he mentioned it again. He said, at the end of the 19th century, the Cerebus Salt Company trademarked a new product, which browned, seasoned, and thickened in one, hence the name Bisto. Now, most stock cubes list less than 10% meat in their ingredients lists. Was it truly awful? No, not at all. The pouring of the steaming unguent, like many ritual foods, meant that quality wasn't necessarily the point. The gravy I loved may have contained only homeopathic quantities of meat, but it was thick, it was hot, brown, salty, and abundant. And you can sign up to see 3 articles a month on the FT website for nothing. You know, it's worth doing just to read that article. Really beautifully written.
Now, here's a place you might not have come across, but it's definitely worth going out of your way for. 7 miles from Cambridge city centre, the Pear and Olive in Hildesham, near Linton. A restaurant with rooms. I spoke first with Gaëlle Lecolli, chef proprietor.
We're just coming up before Christmas and you're having a special opening evening for the Pear and Olive.
Yeah, that's right. We just wanted to have people come in and look at the place. 90% of what we have is sourced locally. And we change our menu pretty much every day. Whatever I can get fresh, that's what we're all about.
So how long have you been open?
3.5 months, pretty much. We didn't advertise, so we want to open this restaurant to be very organic. I think it's working. Yeah.
It has about 20 couples, did you say?
Yeah, 24 seats on the restaurant, about 10 seats at the bar. So we do about 30 seats a night, and we don't turn tables. So everyone who comes, they have a table. They can stay 2 hours, 3 hours, whatever they want. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be rushed. And this restaurant is not about rushing. It's about enjoying.
So what is your background in food?
Classic French cuisine trend in Paris. I did chocolate school in Le Nôtre, and then I went to London when I was 18 and worked in the Trois Gros Brothers in London, Michelin star restaurant. From there, I went to America and I worked several Michelin star restaurants, Beau Rivage, Saddle Peak Lodge, The Ivy, Los Angeles. So I was in LA for about 25 years and then finally opened my own restaurant, which is the French Bulldog. After that, I went to private sector. I worked for several celebrities, including Lionel Richie. And then from there, I went back to Saint-Tropez as a private chef. And then that brought me to Newmarket.
Ah.
And this is where I saw this place, which was actually closed for 5 years. A lot of people was very, very mad that it closed for that long.
The only pub in the village, yeah, as they
yeah,
say.
Yeah, village needs a pub.
Yes.
They need a hub.
Yeah.
And we've been working on this property for about a year and a half now. It just opened 4 months ago, and then that's it.
And
we're here.
We've been doing well.
We've been doing really well. I mean, it's like we're very happy with the income, definitely. Yeah, yeah. It's going to grow. I want to grow organically. I want to grow where it's going to be nice and slow-paced. I mean, we're taking reservation on weekends, a week to 2 weeks in advance. Yeah, during the week, there's no problem. Yeah.
Okay.
We are actually going to start opening lunchtime.
Ah, yeah, that's worth knowing. Yeah.
Yeah, Fridays and Saturdays. We're going to open at 11:30 till 2:30. We open on brunch on Sunday. We do a beautiful roast. And that's probably our most successful day right now, for sure. But we've been open for Sunday brunch for probably 2 months now. So it's catching on really quickly.
Yes. And how do you find people are hearing about you? Word of mouth, Instagram, Twitter, everything?
Yeah. I think it's just word of mouth right now. Honestly, it's just word of mouth. Yeah.
La bouche.
La bouche, well, yeah. That's right. Bouche à oreille.
Ah oui.
Oui,
my French isn't very good, so I will not do any more. And then the design of your restaurant, the bar area, you have an open kitchen.
Yes, we have an open kitchen with barn doors. Mm-hmm. So everybody can walk through and say hi to the chef. And you can walk through to the back where we have a really relaxing room at the back. We can enjoy a glass of wine over there. And it leads to the patio. So it's a really comfortable place. I think my wife, Kat, did an amazing job on the decor.
It is gorgeous.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like you sort of ski lodge chic at the moment.
Yes.
But then in the summer, if you have a patio, I think people in Cambridge will be beating their door
exactly,
to come here.
Exactly, exactly. That's what we're hoping. But yeah, but that's where we're at.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Okay. We hope to see many people here.
Oh, yes, indeed. Thank you. Excellent.
This is an impressive place, and here's Michelle, front of house, to say a bit more about the local provenance of the food.
Very much the speciality is anything that can be shot, acquired, bought, foraged, found locally. So can you just tell me a couple of the dishes that you've had on recently?
Saturday night, we had a pheasant shot within 300 metres of the premises by Mark Huntsman, who lives locally. We stuffed it with foie gras from our butcher in Newmarket, Eric, fantastic butcher. We wrapped it in some beer-smoked bacon, sealed it, and served it on a bed of local celeriac, which was grown by Alex in his allotment, about 50 metres to the north of the building. And we served it with a red wine jus. We tried to serve local food, well-sourced and well-prepared, with no waste. the bones make a stock. Even our fish, if we don't need all the bones, we keep the bones in a freezer, but you always need bones. So we keep everything, we waste nothing. It's part of the ethos of what we do. We buy food, we cook food, then we prepare a menu, and then we don't waste anything.
Wow.
One of the best things we do is run out of food. So on a Friday night, if I run out of a dish, I celebrate the fact I've run out of a dish, but the following day we will have a whole new menu, and that's why it's a celebration that we've run out of food. Next time, book early.
Quite. And I know we will definitely be coming to dine
Fantastic.
Here as many times as we can, I hope.
You're always welcome.
Thank you very much
Thank
indeed.
You very much Thank indeed.
You. And the Pear and Olive is in Hildesham, near Great Abingdon, between Babraham and Linton.
For our final feature today, we take a trip to King's Hedges, where I spoke with Tony Green about the Daily Bread Cooperative. It's an ethical, environmental food shop that, due to its out-of-the-way location, may not be that well known. So Tony, you said that this place has been running since, I think it was roughly about 1992 it opened up. It's always been here on King's Hedges?
Yes, we thought of moving a little while back, but everything was expensive, nothing else had a car park, so That's quite nice. And we did want to be in a location in King's Hedges where we could supply healthy food to people who might not go and seek it out further afield. So it still suits our purpose very well. I think it was a barn in the past. And because we have to fit a warehouse and a packing room, some offices, and the actual retail area with our lovely coffee shop, it's just a great big place to be in. Yeah, I don't think we've got any intention of going anywhere.
But you would never stumble across this place, so you would have to be told about it, I think.
The place has always had its old favourites, like our muesli and the oats and the rice and the lentils, and the basic big tins of olive oil and those kind of things.
We cater for people with special dietary needs, offering healthy, quality products suitable for vegetarians, vegans and celiacs.
We do our best when we're looking at where to source things from. We look at the ethical and the local side.
Shall we have a little tour around?
It's sort of the carbohydrates aisle down one side. The lentils, we sell loads of those. Organic chopped tomatoes in tins and all that kind of stuff comes into it as well. Various ranges of pasta, trying to cater for gluten-free as well as keeping ethically sourced. Rice, again, you can buy that by the sack. Coming down to the olive oils in large tins and bottles as well, and the various different kinds of oils that some of our customers must be amazing cooks, because there's even grapeseed oil, which I hadn't heard of before I started working here. So we have all sorts, including, again, fair trade options and organic options where at all possible. This is our famous fruit and nut aisle, what's famous to us at least. Something we do, it's something called a trail mix, where we mix it ourselves from the various different ingredients. So it's got raisins and coconut chips and almonds and so on to get you through a trek or a marathon or whatever. And obviously there are the organic apricots and organic dates, very, very tasty. More raisins than you can shake a stick at, and sultanas and so on.
Flame raisins, dried fruit salad, whole organic Brazils.
Most of these things in this aisle are packed in our packing room in our labour-intensive way. A good time is had packing, and keeping this stocked up takes up most of the business. We like people to be able to see what we're up to. There's a warehouse you can't actually see into properly, but it's obviously there, which we bring the sacks out, bring them into this packing room here, which is where most of the staff are most of the time.
So this is the packing room now.
Cool. Sorry.
We hire all sorts here.
I love working here.
It's a good bonding place, actually, but it's also the place where we get the stuff on the shelves from. So we've got various tables. We've got a separate nut table, obviously, separate organic table for non-organic. Mike's over there doing mixes at the moment.
Oh, yes, yes.
We had somebody drown in a tub of muesli that we made. He was pulled under by a strong current.
Oh, I knew where you were going with that. I heard that joke the other week.
I've heard that joke a lot. And Tom's washing a scoop. I'm sure the customers will be glad to see, or hear at least, so that we don't cross-contaminate. So it's a busy, busy place. And if someone comes in needing a special size of something that we can sell, so 5 kilos of raisins, for example, we don't put them on the shelves. But if you come to the door and ask, give us 10 minutes and we can rustle you up 5 kilos of raisins or whatever it is you need. So this is the place where it all comes from.
How long have you been here?
6 years. Actually, I knew somebody here who knew I didn't have a job. It was that simple kind of thing, and they knew me and thought I'd suit the place. And yes, it's turned out that way. I very much enjoyed, again, the idea that you can be part of things fully.
Yeah.
And it's a good place to work. When I started shopping here, I thought, this is my kind of place. So very happy to come to work and know that I'm working in a place that does good and produces good food. In all ways, it's a good place.
I guess you operate much like a supermarket. You're always keeping a track of what's selling, what's popular, what isn't, taking advice from customers, saying, oh, will you ever get this product in?
We certainly do take advice from customers, and where possible, we try to please them if there's enough groundswell of opinion. The recent one would be chia seeds, and before that, goji berries, where the customers were asking about them, and we went and looked them up and thought we'd give them a try, and they've gone off very well, particularly, like I say, at the moment, the chia seeds. All things coconut at the moment is a big, big thing. And that's going very well for us, actually.
This is Daily Bread on King's Hedges Road.
You can get so many things here that you just cannot get in the ordinary supermarkets. And I've recently tried a gluten-free diet. And this is the only place that has satisfied everything that I need for that diet. So I'm really happy with it here. And the people here are lovely as well. So it's a good place to come.
One of our briefs is to employ as many people as possible for the local area and include people who have some mental health problems as much as possible, either as volunteers or in some cases as staff. We want to include that in our way of doing things. It's the inclusive way that we want to run the business.
So I've been coming here for years, and I think it's a bit of a local secret.
This is the best Bombay mix in the world, probably. It's from our main wholesaler called Suma, who are lovely, and customers will come in regularly for it. It's one of those that if the customer who comes in for it can't get it, they start looking a little bit itchy and distracted. So it shows we're onto a winner with our Bombay mix.
Now, this is a worker cooperative. Everybody is effectively like a director, really. Everybody is equal.
If and when they become members, yes. Absolutely. That's the plan. The founders, actually, there was a shop in Northampton that started it, and we've nicked their model with their permission. They started it. There was a group of people, Christians, who wanted to work out how to do things in a way that God would be pleased with in retail, and settled on the worker cooperative as the most fair way of reflecting how God would want things done to everybody's equal and to reflect that. So we have a flat pay structure, and all members have say. There is another product that we found, which is our golden granola. It's expensive stuff, but the reason it's expensive is it's got proper stuff in it. And that's another one that once the customer is hooked, we must never run out. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing, full of nutrition and apparently a taste bud delight. There you go. Yes, I've got into toasting sunflower seeds. One of my colleagues got me into it, and I put that in my muesli of a morning with some fair trade sultanas, which I've managed to source. We don't have them here yet, but I've put a word in with the buyers. And of course, some of our jumbo oats and porridge oats just nicely mixed up. And it goes very well with a little bit of toastedness. Very nice.
In amongst the dates, the mango pieces, the pitted prunes, I see something there. This is probably my ignorance. Lemon caps. I've never seen lemon caps before.
Yeah, sadly, you might not see them for much longer. They're basically the skin, or half a skin of a lemon. We used to do the orange caps, and now we can't get them anymore.
Oh.
But normally these days you get it chopped up with the different fruit, but you used to at least, and in this case, certainly for the next couple of months, can get lemon caps, where you get the half the lemon and you can grate it off into your food yourself.
Yeah.
I've got some organic almonds. You know, very difficult to get anywhere else. You can't get them in supermarkets, and some muesli, and some bread is going to get.
Bread we get from various local bakers. And
oh yes, Cobb's Bakery was one.
Cobb's Bakery, Dovecote Bakery are our main two. Also we get from the Incredible Bakery, which is based in Essex, I believe, which does free from almost anything you can think of and still manages to make bread with it. Mm. I guess that's why they call themselves Incredible.
So at least three separate bakers. Does that mean they supply you on different days?
Cobb's is every day. Dovecote is Tuesday and Thursday. Incredible Bakery is just the Thursdays. So we get the bread in.
Yeah.
Somehow.
Wheat flour from Wicken Fen, honey from Sawston, beetroot juice from Gull Orchards in Wisbeach.
So I would guess it was the late 90s when I started coming here. It's a little treasure trove, undiscovered gem. The people are really friendly, the produce is brilliant. It's not even expensive compared to what you pay for organic produce in a supermarket or elsewhere. So I love it to bits. And it's even got a cafe, so what's not to like?
We're Daily Bread on Kilmaine Close, King's Hedges. Please come and see us.
Everyone should know about it.
Thank you.
Daily Bread Cooperative Cambridge will be closed between the 23rd of December through to the 2nd of January, but they will be recruiting in the new year, looking for a full-timer, but part-time offers will be considered too. So, if you fancy that, you can request an application pack by emailing them at contact@dailybreadcambridge.org. Green onions signalling the start of our news section, and we begin as usual with jobs.
News that Stem and Glory, the vegan cafe restaurant in Chesterton Road and King Street, is opening a branch in London. From tomorrow, Sunday, they will close the Chesterton Street branch and search for somewhere more central in Cambridge. Whilst it is closed, the King Street branch is opening in the evening, however, for evening meals. So, the last evening at Chesterton Road is the 23rd of December. Book a table there if you want to go.
And congratulations to Nikki Segnit, who we featured in the last edition of Flavour. Nikki's new book, Lateral Cooking, has been shortlisted for the André Simon Food Book of the Year Award. And so has Shetland by James and Tom Morton, which we featured earlier in the year.
And in terms of local fame, Daniel Clifford of Midsummer House's book was one of the 20 best food books in the Observer newspaper last weekend. Congratulations to him.
And the big news is that it is Christmas on Tuesday. We hope you all enjoy it. And that's all we have time for today. But you can listen again. We are here on alternate Saturdays at 1 p.m, repeated on Sunday at 2 p.m, and then podcast early the following week.
If you want to get in touch with any news or comment when we're off air, you can email us flavour@cambridge105.co.uk or contact us on Twitter at flavour105.
And coming up on Cambridge 105 Radio today is Bookmark. Lee Chambers talks to Mick Finlay about his new novel Arrowwood, set in Sherlock Holmes' Victorian London.
At 3 o'clock, it's Off the Page, short stories, poems and speeches presented by Helen Holgate and Sandra Burney. Today, they're diving into the Christmas spirit with some little-known Christmas-themed treasures.
At 3:30, it's The Science Show. Camilla Lembrick-Turek meets one local scientist per episode and delves into their curiosity and their background.
At 4 p.m, it's 105 This Week, covering the best of the last 7 days of Cambridge 105 Radio.
And then at 5 o'clock, it's the results of the day's local soccer coverage in the Cambridgeshire Football Show, presented by Jack Swindlehurst.
Chris Brown's Soul and Dance Show is on at 6, and Sweet Revenge is at 8 p.m. with Chris Duerden and Beck Conway.
Paul Cristoforo is back on the air at 9 p.m. with Rock of Ages, plus a mystery guest.
And Club Beats rounds off the day's broadcasting, presented by Dave Price and his collection of feel-good dance tunes.
But that's all from us. Flavour will be back on the 5th of January with our Best of 2018. So, until then,
goodbye and happy Christmas!